Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with writer and activist Bill McKibben, author most recently of Falter, now available in paperback, co-founder of the global climate campaign 350.org. Bill's a frequent contributor to The New Yorker, where he recently announced a shift of focus back to an emphasis on organizing, specifically this time of boomers and the silent generation. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. My younger brother gave me Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature, for Christmas 30-plus years ago. It was the first mass audience book about climate change. And what Bill McKibben has done in those 30-plus years is remarkable. His contributions regarding climate go beyond books and articles, though one of his articles in Rolling Stone back in 2012, Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, changed the way many looked at energy reserves and made the case for the fossil fuel divestment movement. He's co-founder of the global climate campaign 350.org, which is among the most effective climate or activist organizations in the world. His argument way back in The End of Nature that the survival of the globe is dependent on a fundamental philosophical shift in the way we relate to nature is more relevant than ever. At The New Yorker for the past 18 months, he's been writing a column titled The Climate Crisis. September 1st of this year, he announced in that column that he was discontinuing it so that he could focus more on organizing, and that he was throwing himself specifically into organizing and mobilizing baby boomers and members of the silent generation. Young people are engaged with climate. He feels they're on the move. But those over 60 are not yet delivering what the crisis demands of them. And he's co-founding an entity called Third Act, dedicated to changing that. I've been developing and talking about something for a few years called 60s 2.0. I apologize right off the bat if the term bothers you, but consider it a working title. I see in millennials and younger a lot of questions, values, and visions that lose nothing of their uniqueness, their timeliness, or their value if I say that I sense they echo the 1960s, the best of the 1960s. But I believe young people and their movements stand a chance today of building something deeper and more sustainable this time with the help of technology, demographics, and a bit of cultural and social evolution. First, technology. Technology available today makes it easier to reduce material consumption. It makes it easier to interact with diverse others unbound by geography and to organize rapidly and efficiently. Second, there's a greatly expanded talent pool. Leadership in the 60s was dominated by males, and except for race-defined organizations, overwhelmingly white. Today, we can tap the genius and energy of not only women, but of so many others whose voices were not heard in those days. And third, I joke in the 60s that there were 100 beatniks in San Francisco and 100 in Greenwich Village, but other than that, we were on our own. Today, and this is where the Third Act comes in, millions of our generation and older welcome and support them. The numbers, resources, and power that our generation's activation can add to their movements could be game-changing. I envision an energized, engaged, effective, intentionally multi-generational alliance tipping things in the right direction in time. And some people might say, what about OK Boomer and the generational, you know, conflicts? At this moment, generational conflict is a distraction. If the challenges we confront are big enough to divide us, then they're big enough to bring us together. We face, but don't face up to, a number of crises: inequality, democracy, racism and otherness, pandemics and public health, climate and nature, with climate probably the most existential. So in the course of the next hour, I want Bill to give us his take on where we stand these days, the evidence of the climate crisis, the obstacles to confronting it successfully, and how and where he sees us moving in the right direction. Then I want him to let us into his thought process, his strategic vision, the personal responses that led him to his new focus on organizing seniors, as well as what he imagined lies ahead. And I want him to flesh out the broader vision of Third Act's target issues beyond climate. In 2014, Bill McKibben was awarded the Right Livelihood Prize, sometimes called the Alternative Nobel. As I've said, he's founder of 350.org, the first planet-wide grassroots climate change movement, which has organized rallies in every country save North Korea. He is now the Schumann Distinguished Scholar in Environmental Studies at Middlebury College and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's written 17 books. His latest is Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out, available now in paperback. Welcome again, Bill McKibben, to Freeform, a World That Just Might Work.
Well, what a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, and let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Monday, October 4th. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about, and this is obviously something that's been a tension for you in the recent past, leading you to that announcement on September 1st. How do you manage to be both an author, a writer, and an activist? One of them primarily solitary, one of them demanding to be social.
Well, yes, it's a good question. I mean, the first conflict, of course, was kind of earlier in my life. I'd spent my life as a journalist, beginning as a newspaperman at a very young age. You know, I've been writing for money, I guess, for the local paper since I was 14, even if it wasn't much money, 25 cents a column inch covering basketball games. But, you know, my father was a journalist, and I understood the journalistic idea that one wrote about things, but one didn't become involved in them. That there were lines you didn't cross, and so even after I'd written The End of Nature and was very, very absorbed in the climate crisis, writing constantly, speaking constantly, it was still hard to decide that at a certain point it was going to be necessary to also take up activism. But that decision was made easier by the fact that we'd reached the point where clearly writing another book wasn't really going to move the needle. And what I finally figured out, I guess, was that what I had thought was an argument, and an argument about data and reason and evidence, was really a fight about what fights are always about, money and power. Mm. And we'd won the argument. I mean, it was very clear what was going on with climate change. We were just losing the fight because Exxon et al. Had so much more power than we did. We weren't going to get it by having billions of dollars. They were always going to win in that department. And the only alternative was to start building movements, you know, to kind of try and deal in the currency of movements, passion, spirit, creativity, sometimes the willingness to spend one's body and go to jail. And so that's what, you know, that was the big turn in my life. I've obviously kept writing, maybe writing even more, but it's also now very connected with this other work in the world.
You know, one thing that I hadn't even thought to ask you, but it in terms of your work, it has become, and this now goes on for perhaps we're at decades, where the issue of climate and the issue of our relationship to the rest of nature is the lane you're in. You didn't set out that way, did you?
No, it's my first job out of college was writing the Talk of the Town column for the New Yorker magazine.
Yeah.
And in those days, it was, the one rule of the New Yorker of Talk of the Town in those days was it couldn't be about anybody famous. So I had the incredibly pleasant job of bopping around New York City, just talking to ordinary people about remarkably funny and interesting things that they were doing. And I wrote hundreds of those. In those days, it was all anonymous, which I quite liked.
Mm.
And I think that if the world was as it should be, I could very happily have spent my whole life doing pretty much that.
Yeah.
So it was more, actually, the story of how I started to think in environmental terms, I think, was also connected to New York. I wrote a very long piece, my first long piece for The New Yorker when I was 24, 25, about where everything in my apartment came from. I had a sublet at Bleecker and Broadway, and I followed everything, the utility lines back to Brazil where Con Ed was buying oil, or the water lines out along New York's remarkable reservoir system, or, on and on and on. And by the time I was done, for the first time in my life, I had, I think, a strong sense of just how physical a place the world really was. I'd grown up in the suburbs, which are a machine for hiding the operations of the physical world. And Manhattan seems a place able to just mint money and ideas out of thin air, But it turns out that it was exquisitely dependent on the world operating the way that it always has. And so I think that set me up for reading the early climate science in the mid to late 1980s, just as it was beginning to emerge in journals and things, and taking it more seriously than I otherwise would have, because I was freshly imbued with this sense of the fragility, really, of our physical arrangements here. And I think in a way that's what gave rise to The End of Nature, the first book about any of this stuff, and really what's turned into my subsequent life's work. But you're right, that was not the plan.
Right. But yeah, it occurred to me that, yeah, once you felt the calling, as it will, and the need, it kind of shaped things for you. Let me ask that first question about the state of things that just sort of I always feel like, whether it's in that column in the New Yorker or blog posts and so on, you've got the latest. And so how do you assess the, sort of where we stand? And I'd put that in three big headings. One is, the latest, clearest evidence of the climate crisis, which I think is apparent to most people, whether it's the fires, the floods, the hurricanes, and so on, the heat waves, the droughts. But you may have some particular nuggets that if a listener hears it, they'll slap their head and it'll make an impression. And then the latest in terms of the emerging and available solutions, and then the obstacles, and that kind of sets up the narrative.
Sure. Well, so the first is, at some level, I guess, always the most important. Climate change is a huge physical crisis grounded in math, in physics, in chemistry. We have a good scientific understanding, obviously, of what's going on. When you burn coal and gas and oil, you put carbon in the atmosphere, its molecular structure blocks heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. 30 years ago, scientists, beginning with Jim Hansen at NASA, gave us a set of forecasts for how much the temperature was going to go up. And they've been pretty much spot on. So far we've raised the temperature of the Earth about 1 degree Celsius. The place where people underestimated was what the effects of that change would be. And so the physical effects we're seeing on the Earth right now are really what scientists had thought would be coming much later in this century as temperatures rose much more. But it turned out the Earth was quite finely balanced. So that 1 degree Celsius, or 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, that's been enough to melt most of the sea ice in the summer Arctic. As a result, both the jet stream and the Gulf Stream are now behaving in heretofore unseen and highly dangerous ways. It's been enough to alter the the world's hydrology, the way that water moves around the planet. If you wanted one fact to kind of bear in mind to understand where we are, it's just that warm air holds more water vapor than cold. And so in California, you get these, and other arid places, you get these intense droughts, and with high heat and heat waves, they trigger fires on a scale we have not seen before. The worst ones in the world this year are not in the West, bad as those have been, but in Siberia, and they're pouring huge amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. Once that water vapor has evaporated up into the air, it's going to come down. So in wet places, we see this strong, strong increase in deluge and downpour. I was in New York City last month when the remnants of Hurricane Ida came through and produced the biggest rainstorm in New York's recorded history, breaking the record that had been set 11 days earlier. That was really scary, I gotta say. I mean, people in the richest city in the world were drowning in their basement apartments.
Yeah, I remember that was so striking to me. I'm out here in fire country in Los Angeles, but that the death toll of Ida was greater in New York and New Jersey than in Louisiana.
Yep. And these are the kind of, you know, we see a lot of this now. I mean, all the biggest rainstorms in U.S. history have occurred in the last 3 or 4 years. And so these kind of changes are what happen when you increase the temperature 1 degree. So the danger is that we're on a trajectory where we'll increase the temperature 3 degrees Celsius before the end of the century. And if that happens, then I think it's pretty clear we're not going to have civilizations that resemble the ones we're used to. That's just too much violent, chaotic flux in too many systems all at once. Just to give the, you know, one example, the UN High Commissioner on Refugees estimates the kind of high-end damage would be 1 billion climate refugees by some point later in this century. If you think about that even for a moment, you begin to understand why it just, we can't let anything like that happen. I mean, 1 million refugees managed to completely destabilize Western Europe politically. A similar number managed to turn our politics end over end. Now imagine what happens with flows of human beings 1,000 times that size. So our job is to somehow hold the increase in temperature, as we promised to do in Paris, to 2 degrees Celsius or below, as close to 1.5 degrees as possible. That's obviously very hard to do. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, our scientific experts, said in 2018 that if we wanted to have any chance of meeting those Paris targets, then we needed to cut our emissions in half by 2030, which is now 8 years and loose change away. So we're up against it. So that goes.
So they said that in 2018.
Yes.
So that's they said it 3 years ago. We've got 8 years left, and everything I read says we're. I think it was Pogo who said that. The behinder and the behinder we get.
Well, that's for sure. I'll add that, you know, the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill now before Congress would put us on a path to get, in this country anyway, somewhere near those totals if we did it. So the reason that that's even possible, and this goes to the second part of your question, one of the big changes over the last 10 years has been that scientists and engineers have done an elegant job of bringing down the cost of renewable energy. They've brought it down something like 90%. So solar power and wind power, which were expensive luxuries a decade ago, are now the cheapest ways to generate power around this planet. And we now have batteries to store that power that are dropping at the same economic rate. That's very good news. It allows us to imagine doing what we need to do. There's no longer the series of technological and financial obstacles that once existed. But you asked about what obstacles there are.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, the vested interest of the fossil fuel industry has not gone away, and continues to prevent action on the scale that we need. And that's a big part of the drama that's taking place in Washington right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You don't need to be a great savant to watch Joe Manchin do his best to defend the fossil fuel industry. It's given him more money than any other person in Washington, D.C., which is, by the way, saying a lot. So that fight is very much on. And the other piece of good news that's happened over the last 10 years is the rise of this big movement around the world. 350.org was an early iteration, and we've seen so many others. The Sunrise Movement, which brought us the Green New Deal, and indirectly this, work that's underway in Congress now. Extinction Rebellion, the remarkable story of junior high school and high school students around the world. We know Greta Thunberg, and we should. She's fantastic. I love her and adore working with her. But there are 10,000 Greta Thunbergs, and they have 10 million followers, and they're making this maybe the biggest movement in human history, which is good because it's the biggest problem we've ever come up against. So those are the balance of forces. The eventual outcome of the story is not in doubt. The world is going to run on clean energy 50 years from now, because it's clean and because it's cheap. But if it takes us anything like 50 years to get there, the world that we run on sun and wind is going to be a broken world. So the purpose of movements is to keep the pressure on precisely in order that we can force the rapid transition that we need. What we're about now is pace. About how to see if we can do this before we run out of time. And part of that action is in Washington and other national capitals around the world, hence everyone's attention to this big reconciliation bill. And part of that action is on Wall Street and other financial capitals around the world, hence the work that we're all doing around things like divestment or around challenging the big banks and insurance companies and asset managers that are the financial lifeline for the fossil fuel industry.
Yes. Let me just make a couple of comments. One is I recently introduced Michael Mann, interviewed Michael Mann, the one who came up with the hockey stick graph and climate scientist. And his new book makes very much the point you were just making. It's the new climate war. He says they can't, the opponents of climate action can't make the argument of denial with a straight face anymore because of the floods and fires and things we spoke of. And so they have shifted to delay, distract, and disable our attempts to change. And I think that's very much the point you're making, that we're into, it's about time. I noticed that I have begun to say, will we make the necessary changes in time? Will we transform this system in time? And I think that sense of the problem, as you say, we will end up running society on clean energy. It's a question of what that society will look like.
Yes, exactly right.
And then to say, just briefly speak about Congress, because by the time this posts and so on, hopefully that has been settled and so on. But there is, I think, a phenomenally discouraging sense when it hits me, not only that we exist in this country, which is, the wealthiest and, among the very top in terms of polluters, that we exist in a situation of minority rule. And that even if the public favors climate action, and even if the public favors specific climate action, and even if the numbers are not even close, the way that Washington and the Republican Party approaches governance now means that the battle, like I said before, the battle is about time and pace. And here, the battle is not whether the majority can be convinced, but whether the majority's will can be done.
Absolutely. And it's why there's one of the reasons why it's super important that as we work on protecting the environment, part of that work is around protecting democracy.
Absolutely.
So that we have some hope of actually prevailing here.
Yeah, and that there's the one that like haunts me is that there are two senators currently in the United States who, in some sense, have the fate of the world in their hands. Right? As much as the U.S. needs to move, as much as this is the first serious attempt, that what's in that bill, and as much as they're blocking it, this isn't a game anymore. This isn't just politics. This is crisis. This is emergency.
Well, and you really sense that, Terrence, because what we do over the next month or two in this country will determine what the chances are for any effective progress as we do kind of global negotiations around climate. So it's very clear that the Biden administration wants to wrap up this reconciliation bill and things by October 31st. That's what they've said. And one reason is because November 1st sees the kickoff of this huge global conclave in Glasgow, which will be the most important climate meeting since the Paris Accords in 2015. John Kerry has been working around the clock for a year to try to line up international support for more ambition than we showed in Paris. That's what's necessary to knock that 3 degrees down to 2 degrees or 1.5. But, you know, he's not going to have much luck if the U.S. sends him off, you know, naked to the conference.
Yeah.
We got to give him something to work with, and that something is precisely the measures in that reconciliation bill. So, you know, Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema are playing not just a national level high stakes game, but a planetary scale one.
Yeah, and a societal scale. In other words, you know, I remember one of the things that was clearest to me in the 2016 election was that those people who thought, "What the hell? Let's give Trump a try." You know, Hillary's been around for 30 years, not enough has changed. What do we have to lose? And it was, wait, with climate change and inequality and democracy, we don't have 4 years to waste. And now, even having the public having spoken in 2020, we find ourselves in the position we're in. Hopefully, we send John Kerry to Scotland with something.
Yep. It's very well put. And this really does feel, because of the time limits, as if this is a particularly crucial moment.
Yeah.
Really, I think the last period of time when we're going to have significant leverage over the physics of climate change is likely to be this decade. We have to get a huge amount of the work done now. And if we're going to get work done here and around the world in the course of this decade, inertia is enough of a force that this really seems like our last real chance to get it started.
That's right. A stone rolls down the hill or it doesn't. And if this inertia you're talking about, if it doesn't start moving, then it can't pick up speed. And we'll see. What's your sense of where China is right now?
Well, China is in a fascinating place. China, you know, has more to fear from climate change than just about anybody. China's, you know, manufacturing base on the Pearl River Delta is all, you know, a meter or so above sea level. And the great rivers that flow out of the Himalayas are its lifeline, but those glaciers are melting. So and China's, you know, one of the biggest threats to its the political legitimacy of the ruling party is has been the extreme air pollution in its urban centers. So China has real reason to try and clean up its act, and it's been doing a lot of that. It's been installing renewable energy faster than any place on Earth. But China also has its own, you know, fossil fuel slash economic growth lobby that pushes it to keep expanding power production at any cost. And so coming out of the pandemic, they've also been putting up coal-fired power again. The best news that came out of China this year was a promise a few weeks ago that the Bank of China would no longer finance coal power in other parts of the world, because that's been the biggest threat, China's willingness to use its often outdated coal technology to build huge amounts of power in other parts of Asia, Africa, so on. And they've promised now not to do that, which is potentially game-changing. It seems like the biggest thing they'll be bringing to this Glasgow meeting. And I think it's a kind of gambit to see what we come up with.
Mm-hmm. And as I was going to say, if you have to deal with the air pollution in your own country, but you still want to invest in coal plants, the way they did it was to scale them back at home and continue to build them around the world. And so that's
why it's a big deal.
Yeah,
yep.
That's why it's a big deal. I also will just put aside, because I don't think we have time to deal with it, is something which haunts me, which is that if China, with its authoritarian system, is able to make decisions quicker and mobilize industries quicker and ends up, you know, being the claiming to have saved us from climate change, what that will say about the way we organize ourselves as democracies or as authoritarian societies going forward.
It's the one place where it can, you know, China, a deep human rights abuser, a model for a kind of world we should not want, the most advanced surveillance state in the world, clearly is making its case for some kind of moral high ground when it comes to climate change. And given the existential stakes, I think you're right. It's a real, it's one more reason for the West to take seriously the damage it's done and what it needs to do now.
And I think the case that China would be watching right now is, can those two senators hold the world hostage? And does that just show that democracy is not going to do it?
Yeah.
And so it's how all of these things, you know, interconnect and shine their lights on each other. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Bill McKibben, author most recently of Falter, F-A-L-T-E-R, Falter, now available in paperback, frequent contributor to The New Yorker, and co-founder of the global climate campaign 350.org, and the New Climate Campaign. Well, actually, it's broader than a climate campaign, the New Organizing Campaign, thirdact.org. And you can learn more about all of his work and writing at BillMcKibben.com. Let's turn now. As I said, you announced on September 1st that you were going to scale back at least that column on the climate crisis, and that you were going to devote more of yourself to organizing, and specifically to organizing boomers and seniors. As I said in the intro, let us in on your thought process, your strategic considerations, your personal gut feelings, and so on, that went into that shift. And I'd say almost the bigger shift is the new target audience, where 350 was clear. I think I've told you I was in the audience in 2012 when you and a few members of 350 pitched divestment at UCLA. Yep. And that was in the very early days, and it was clearly aimed at youth, and I think we're not out of the woods, but successful.
Yep.
And so what went on, and how long was this process, and what tipped you over, and those sorts of things?
Well, it's still very much ongoing, and it's by no means just me. We've been doing this, you know, work with a lot of people, and it's been interesting and fun, and will continue to be as we kind of officially launch it.
Let me just tell people, by the way, let me just cut in for 1 second. If you go to thirdact.org, there's not a lot of information up there. They haven't laid a whole bunch of it out, but there is a wonderful, I think it's about a 7-minute video that features Bernie Sanders, Jane Fonda, Robin Kimmerer, Reverend Yearwood, and so on. A few people just speaking to why they are part of Third Act. And that begins to give you a feel.
Yes, and hopefully there'll be more soon. So here's the thing. You know, I've mostly organized with people much younger than myself. Mm-hmm. I started 350.org with 7 college students here at Middlebury. And almost all the, most of the people that it eventually ended up employing were much younger than I am. And I loved that. And you know, you'll recall that when that work began 10 or 15 years ago, there were lots of people saying, oh, youth today just are apathetic and don't get it. And, you know, what's wrong with kids today and so on. And I don't think you hear anyone saying that anymore, between Black Lives Matter and the climate strikes and, you know, on and on. It's clear that the environmental movement, the civil rights movement, all powered by remarkable young people, bringing remarkable new sense of the world to bear. And that's powerful and transformative. It's also, I think, unfair and probably unproductive to demand that they do all this work themselves. Think about our country. Baby boomers and the silent generation are enormous block. There's about 70 million people. About 10,000 people a day turn 60, which is about as many people as are born in the U.S. every day. And so it's you know, this is a huge generation. They vote in extraordinary numbers. 2020 was the biggest youth turnout we've ever had in our electoral system. But, you know, older people still voted. We're still half again as likely to vote as younger people. And fairly or not, I'd say probably not to a large degree, most of the country's assets ended up in the hands of these generations. The baby boomers and the silent generation have about 70% of the wealth in the country at the moment, compared to about 5% for millennials. So if we're going to be able to put sufficient pressure on political systems and financial systems to do something about climate, to do something about voter suppression, to do something about these other issues that seem to me to constitute some of the unfinished business of our generations, then we're going to need older people backing up younger people. Now, the conventional wisdom, and there's some evidence to back this up, is that people become more conservative as they age. And certainly, you know, there are forces trying to take advantage of that. The Koch network has done a great job of trying to organize seniors. Fox News is, you know, demographically, its median viewer is 68 years old, which is pretty remarkable if you think about it. But I think there are things about our generation that may allow it to flip the script a little bit. You know, our first act, boomers and people a little bit older, was pretty interesting, as you were talking about the 60s a little while ago. I mean, we were around for a period if we didn't participate in, we at least bore witness to a period of pretty profound cultural and political transformation.
Cut in, because this is something that I want to make a point on, which is that there's an interesting book by Edward P. Morgan called What Really Happened in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks, one thing he looks at is how the media is very much how many people get their feeling about the 60s, and that the media seized on certain kinds of images and so on. And what he says, and this is why I cut in, is he says, you know, if you look at what was really going on in the 60s, they were questioning an awful lot of systemic things, racism, gender things, relationships between the genders, environment, diet, you know, peace, corruption, all of these things. And the media couldn't deal with all that, A, because it's the manufactured media or the mainstream media, and it's owned by the corporations that depend on things staying the way they are, but B, just because it needs a shorthand. And so it made it a generational, generational event, generation versus generation, generation gap. He says, no, it was a much deeper questioning, and this thing of labeling it generation was a way of short shrifting it all. I just want to say that because I do think it's those systemic questions that are that we're talking about dealing with now.
I think that's very true, but I also think that one of the reasons that that happened was because there was this unprecedentedly huge generation that had arrived just at that period. And it's the same generation that's still working its way, you know, the bulge that's still working its way down the snake. And so that if that generation, the boomers and the silent generation, maybe our second act was somewhat less interesting than our first, you know. Maybe it had a little more to do with consumerism than it did with citizenship. Maybe we were a little quick to, you know, buy into Reaganism and all it represented, so on and so forth. Whatever, you know, that's history too.
Let me jump in just very quickly on that one, which, because again, I certainly agree with you, and you know I think we were a disappointment based on our early promise. That's me. But a couple of things that one you can never leave out is the assassinations that took place. You take away charismatic leaders who are able to bring out the best in people, and you knock off three or four of them, and then pretend that didn't happen, and that Reagan arose, you know, out of a hunger in the country.
No, that's a different, it's a very different world if Bobby Kennedy isn't shot and wins the presidency in 1968, and he has Dr. King there to buttress him, and you know, we never have Richard Nixon and Watergate.
So that's one. And the other, of course, is in 1970 we have Milton Friedman saying shareholder value is the only duty of a corporation, and Lewis Powell saying, "Hey, business, don't let these young people get away with this."
Yep, absolutely. So you know, there comes the Ayn Randian, you know, world that we're all too familiar with. But now, you know, we're emerging at the age of 60 or 70 or whatever we are, with a lot of skills, a lot of resources, again, perhaps more than our fair share, and now some kids or grandkids, and hence new reason to be worried about the legacy we're about to leave behind as the only generation that left the world a worse place than we found it. And so I think that there may be real opportunities, appetites among people to go to work on changing some of that. And in particular on figuring out how to back up young people doing such great work now. So for instance, the very first sort of very small trial project that Third Act is taking on is answering the call, the youth climate movement, Fridays for the Future in the U.S., has put out a call to take on the big banks, especially Chase and Citi, that are the biggest lenders to the fossil fuel industry, something I've been working on myself for some years. And so when they are rallying inside and outside those bank branches on October 29th, that'll be very powerful. No bank manager wants a bunch of 19-year-olds breathing down their neck. But it may be even more powerful if there are some 69-year-olds there too, because, you know, any good bank manager is well aware of whose money sits in his vaults, you know.
Yep.
So it's a sort of perfect kind of example of the ways that there may be room for big intergenerational collaboration going forward. This is just beginning. And it's, as I say, it's not just me by any means. We've had, you know, wonderful leadership from people like Akaya Windwood, who, you know, used to run Rockwood Leadership Institute, from Norman Lear, who's 99, from Greta Thunberg, who's 18, from all the people who are chipping in to help in get it off the ground. And we'll see what happens. But I do think it's, for the reasons that we've been talking about all hour, it's an all hands on deck moment. You know, the world is existentially threatened in a way that it hasn't been before. And it's going to take every one of us. That's not a rhetorical idea.
Right.
It's just a mathematical reality that if we can't get every good-hearted person on the planet engaged and in sort of in harness going in the same direction, our odds are pretty small.
Yeah, and what I see also is my initial thought when I read your announcement in the New Yorker on September 1st, even though it wasn't exactly what the words said, my original thought was, oh, this is a climate organization, like 350. But it is broader than that.
Yes.
In the ways that those other crises we've talked about.
Yes. Well, the other first thing we're going to really try to work on is voter suppression. And if you think about it, I mean, I think it's arguable that the single best thing that happened in our lifetimes in this country may have been the passage of the Voting Rights Act, that it represented, you know, decades, centuries of historical struggle, and it was just a remarkable achievement. And to watch it getting eroded away is almost too painful for words. And so it's, you know, this generation in particular that needs to stand up and defend the legacy that it helped build. We're collecting, among other things, collecting stories from people about the meaning of voting in their lives over their lifetimes, the times when it really mattered, the races that, you know, that hung on a few votes, the times that they felt that change really had come through the ballot box. It, as part of the effort to really make the case for why we've got to protect everybody's right to vote, we've got to make it's just crazy that we don't make it as easy as humanly possible for people to vote, since that's the thing that lies at the basis of our system and our claim to some kind of legitimacy.
Yeah, and that since the call of Third Act, the call of 350, the call of elders climate action, you know, a group that already that's out there as well.
Yes,
all of them say, and the people that I speak to on a regular basis, individual action is fine, and the fossil fuel industry would love it if that's how you thought about it.
Yep,
that's part of their delaying and disabling tactic. But collective action is what's needed, and let's not kid ourselves. Elections are not everything. Elections
yep.
are not democracy, but they are essential. They are collective action.
Hey, in our system, in even numbered years, when you get to the autumn, they're the biggest leverage you got. But the day the election's over is still a day for political action too, and all the other days. And one of the things I keep trying to remind people is, there are two huge power centers in our society. One of them is Washington, the other is Wall Street, and we have to be able to pull both those levers. And so that's why we organize in a lot of the ways we do. over the years, kind of dividing our efforts to make sure that we're taking on big money in all its guises. And it's why we've enjoyed and found really fruitful this huge divestment campaign, and hope that work on banks and things that really going after in certain ways the heart of capital will be useful. It's a big target, so
yeah,
who knows.
When I first was thinking about this conversation, I thought divestment was such a perfect target for young people because many of them were in colleges who had endowments.
Yep.
And so it was a great, as well as a actual shift, it was a great movement building tool.
You are absolutely right.
Now,
but it's also,
I was thinking, does that work with seniors? And that's when I realized, yes, it's not now, but now it's not about colleges, although they are who the alumni associations care about.
Yes, yes. No, it's pension funds are the biggest single source of money in the world. And increasingly, they're falling in line in the right way because people are organizing. 3 or 4 days ago, the pension system for Quebec, which turns out to be the 12th largest pension fund on earth, divested from fossil fuel, following the lead of the New York City and New York State pension funds, which are also in the top 15 pension funds around the world. The state of Maine just voted its legislature to divest its pension fund. There's a huge fight on in California to get CalPERS and CalSTRS, the teachers and public employees retirement funds, to divest from fossil fuel. And these things are really, really important. And so older people can play a huge role in this. At this point, a huge percentage of the world's colleges and universities have divested from fossil fuel. Even Harvard, the most recalcitrant member of the establishment, finally came around earlier this autumn. So a lot of the action really is moving in other directions too now, and that's beautiful to see.
Yeah, but it does. But it is where you can galvanize collective action, and as I said, now it moves to, as we're saying, it moves to insurance, it moves to banks, it moves to equity funds, it moves, and there's a lot of power there. I recently did a show with Robert Polen and Dave Campbell. Do you know who I'm talking about or not?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, with their work on a just transition. I get almost emotionally touched with this, but that the oil workers' unions working with economists to lay out a plan that takes care of the workers and moves us forward rather than fighting change.
Yep. I mean, look, the truth be told, the odds of us making all the changes we need to make in the time that we have are probably less than half. But we have to push extraordinarily hard because the stakes are so high that, whatever we can do to change the odd sum is well worth it. And so there are 100 places, 100 fronts in this fight. And it's very, very good to see people fighting on almost all of them. You know, we have people taking on the law firms that back up big oil. Students are refusing to go to work at them. We have this huge movement now within, of all places, the advertising and PR world to stop the big firms from advancing these hideous campaigns, greenwashing big oil, on and on and on. Wherever people are situated, they can find a place to fight. And part of the work of doing this work at Third Act is to remind people that even if they're no longer working or whatever, they still have ways to have plenty of traction and purchase on the world around them in order to get stuff done.
I was going to say, when you said that there are two centers of power in this country, Washington, D.C. and Wall Street, and I was going to say the third one, in a way, is everybody's online world. If you know what I mean, the information that they're, and the communities that they are part of through Facebook, Instagram, and so on. And I think we've got to get a handle on that one, too, because of the, it will obviously be is being and will continue to be used by those PR firms and by those fossil fuel industry to
there are days when I was just writing today that there are moments when Facebook feels to me like it's doing to our mental environment what Exxon is doing to our physical environment.
And yeah,
they're very comparable in a lot of ways.
Right, and so yes, when Third Act takes on democracy, inequality, public health, and climate, taking on the algorithms of the tech industry is a big part of that. We've got about a minute and a half. If you were going to pitch to listeners what they could most do, and looking into Third Act, I think would certainly be a part of it. What's your pitch?
Well, I mean, you said it before eloquently, so I will try to restate it. The most important thing an individual can do at this point, we're past the point where you can make the math of these dilemmas, climate change in particular, where you can really make the math square one Tesla at a time, one vegan dinner at a time. Those things are great, but the most important thing an individual can do is be less of an individual and join together with others in movements large enough to allow us to make changes in basic political and economic ground rules. That can only be done by coming together to build movements. That's what our history tells us, and we've got to hope that we still, despite the craziness of our online world, despite the huge imbalances of power built into from things like Citizens United, we have to hope that we can still build movements that are able somehow to tip the balance. We're getting there. The growth of these movements over the last 10 years has begun to counterbalance the power of the fossil fuel industry, say. But we're not there yet, as you know, as is vividly illustrated in Washington, where we've been able to kind of force the question for the first time around things like climate change or voter suppression. We've got enough people to force the question, but not enough people yet to carry the question. So that's our job.
Yeah, tip that scale, and because the public. And that's certainly Democrats, certainly independents, and a good deal of Republicans is in favor of dealing with this stuff. Once we build that movement, I think there is a chance that things tip. You know what I'm saying? That there's that there is a potential of a momentum shift, and that's that's exciting.
Your lips to God's ear, brother. There we go.
Okay, so the websites to learn more about Bill's work. There's BillMcKibben.com. That's his writing, his books, his history. There's 350.org. That's the numbers, 350.org. And there's Third Act, one word, thirdact.org. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, all one word. At the same website, if you want to receive my weekly announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about via email, and usually about 10 articles that flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Free Forum podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, most major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site or at those sites. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos of Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Bill McKibben. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, and on we go.